Welcome to the FDD Events Podcast. I'm Cliff Mate, founder and president of FDD, and pleased to share with you the following conversation. Please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast so you don't miss out on future FDD events.
Good morning. It's Monday, March 11th. The war in the Middle East is now 157 days old. I'm Jonathan Schanzer, Senior Vice President for Research at Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Welcome back to the FDD Morning Brief. The news doesn't stop for anyone or anything in the Middle East, certainly not daylight savings time. Being tired is no excuse. At least that's our mindset here at the Morning Brief. We keep tracking the biggest stories and even some of the smaller ones, and then we break it all down for you three times a week. So thanks, as always, for tuning in. In a few minutes, you'll get a chance to hear from Saudi journalist and commentator Abdulaziz Al-Khamis. I interviewed Abdulaziz late last week. We spoke about the war in the Middle East, the chances of a Saudi-Israeli normalization deal, and more. But right now, I want to talk about Ramadan. First of all, Ramadan Kareem to all who are celebrating. For those unfamiliar, Ramadan is a month-long holiday that takes place during the ninth month of the Muslim calendar. From sunup to sundown, Muslims are required to fast. When the sun sets, families and friends get together and they feast. It's a beautiful holiday of prayer, introspection, and togetherness. Here's what it's not about: violence. And yet, this is exactly what Hamas and other Iran-backed terrorist groups would have us believe, that this holy month is a trigger for terrorism and bloodshed. To be fair, they didn't invent this. During the Iraq War some 20 years ago, the insurgency groups made a point of escalating attacks during the holiday. Others have historically done the same. Remarkably, our media tries to explain this as a rational phenomenon. They imply that Muslims get violent during Ramadan because they are hungry and angry, or hangry, as the kids say. This is asinine. Can you imagine our media warning that Jews might go ballistic on Yom Kippur because they're fasting, or that we should avoid Catholics on Ash Wednesday, Good Friday, or during Lent because they're iron deficient? Preposterous. No, I'm going with Senator John Fetterman from the great state of Pennsylvania. He boldly proclaimed, quote, "Hamas cowards hide in tunnels, hospitals, schools, and refugee camps, now behind a holy time," end quote. Kudos to Fetterman. But he shouldn't be the one saying it. Muslim governments should be slamming the exploitation of the Muslim faith. Imams should be speaking out against this during their sermons, too. For more than two decades, we've been hearing about how Islam is a religion of peace. I don't contest that, but Hamas certainly seems to. On 10/7, Hamas took 240 Israelis hostage. This Ramadan, it would appear that 1.9 billion Muslims are being held hostage by the Iran-backed terrorist group, too. Now for your headlines. Headline one: as if on cue, Israeli police scuffled with worshippers outside the Al-Aqsa compound in Jerusalem on the first night of Ramadan. Does this mean we're watching a third intifada? It's too soon to know. What we do know is that Yahya Sinwar, the head of Hamas, is banking on this. The head of the Mossad, David Barnea, said so in an interview the other day. Namely, Sinwar wants to set the entire region on fire during this month. Can he do it? Good question. Back in 2021, when Israel and Hamas fought for 11 days, the terror group was able to promote violence in Jerusalem, the West Bank, and across multiple Arab-Israeli towns. That was the result of an operations room based in Lebanon that activated multiple cells. Obviously, that didn't happen all at once last night, but Israeli police did arrest several Arab Israelis plotting an attack over the weekend. And now we have a whole month to see whether Sinwar can put his money where his mouth is. By the way, there are reports this morning that Israel took out Hamas's number two in the military wing, Marwan Issa. We'll be watching to see if that triggers an escalation on the part of Hamas. Headline two: new armed groups are forming in the Gaza Strip, according to a report from Israel's Channel 14. Not jihadist groups, thankfully. From what the Israelis have gathered, it appears these groups are trying to secure the delivery of aid and to prevent diversion to Hamas. They apparently are also trying to make sure that Gazans are getting electricity and water. This is particularly heartening as the focus on humanitarian assistance has intensified and as the international community mulls more and more what happens the day after. Foreign actors will rebuild Gaza. This much we know. But we will need to ultimately find people who are willing and able to run this coastal enclave. So is this a positive sign of things to come? We won't know for some time, but I'll be watching. And headline three, the White House is taking aim at the government of Benjamin Netanyahu. The knives are drawn, folks, and it's not pretty. In a display of mental gymnastics, both the president and the vice president are trying to convey something a little nuanced, namely that they don't want to conflate the people of Israel with the Netanyahu government, which they're targeting. I think they're being too clever by half. Bibi is still the elected prime minister of Israel, at least for now. And as he said yesterday in an interview, his views largely align with the Israeli public, and he's not wrong. I avoid playing favorites with Israeli politicians. I avoid it like the plague. But that appears to be exactly what this White House is doing 1 week after Benny Gantz showed up in Washington without Netanyahu's permission. I don't see how this makes America look like a champion of democracy. I also don't think the White House understands the extent to which the majority of Israelis are unified. Even the many Israelis who dislike Bibi want to destroy Hamas at all costs, and that won't change no matter who is prime minister. Okay, it's now time to hear from Abdulaziz Al-Khamis. He is a Saudi journalist and commentator. He does most of his work in Arabic, but he was kind enough to speak to the FTD Morning Brief in English. We spoke last week about a number of issues that I think you'll find interesting. He is the first Saudi national to appear on this show, and today just happens to be Saudi National Flag Day. Welcome, Abdulaziz Al-Khamis.
Hi, how are you? Thank you.
Well, let's jump right in here. My first question for you is about how the Saudis, the Emiratis, have long been concerned about the Houthis. We know that they have fought a war against the Houthis, an Iran-backed terror group in Yemen. But since this war began, it seems like the Saudis and the Emiratis in particular have stopped fighting as the U.S. has gotten more involved, as the Israelis have been targeted. What do you think explains this shift in policy from the Saudis and the Emiratis in particular?
I think because it's not a revenge with the American and British. It's kind of not involving and rising the threats in the region if they engage in this war. And they know exactly when the Saudis and the Emiratis, they are have a war in Yemen, they know they have a war on behalf of the world against people in Yemen, and they hijacked the government, they did massacres to the people, and we know all of this, but the American, they, especially the Democrats department, they don't understand the full game of this, what's happening in the region and what's happening in Yemen. And they know, even they thought about Houthi, they are nothing. They will not create a big damage to the world. But now they understand it. And with a relation, good relation with Iran, and or to stabilize and to make a peace in the region, the Saudi policy is not going far in the wars. They won't stop fighting on behalf of the world if the world not helped them before. And when they need the world with them against those Houthis, the world don't involve. Why the world coming back, especially United States and Britain, to ask them to engage in a war? They always talk about it as a threat, and the American, they ignore. And you remember that when the threat to go to the UN to stop Saudi and Emiratis not to go inside Hodeidah, the Tuhama, the sea shore of Yemen. And what we call it, it's not Saudi problem or Emiratis problem. It's American politics strategy. They don't understand the threats for the future. That's why Saudi go to the war in Yemen. Okay, the Saudis limit the damage because they liberate with the Emiratis 2/3 of the country. But believe it if the Houthis, they capture all of Yemen, what will happen to the region, what will happen to, so it will become like Hezbollah in Lebanon against Israel. It will become other threat, and the American and British and European, they not understand it, and I think they should understand it now. If they want to defeat the Houthis, they should work. Until now, they don't do the job very well. And until now, they not do it very well, and they not serious about it, as we said. And it's very strange. You find a lot of Saudis talk about it as the American not involved in a war against Houthis. They just have small operations to just stop the Houthis, and they still communicate with the Omani to let the Houthis stop. But we know Houthis is not a political group. They know and they understand the risks, and they care about their people, they care about their nation. They are ideological people, threat, they are fanatic and radical Muslim group. They are same like Daesh, same like Qaeda.
I think that's right. And I think the U.S. is finally coming to terms, perhaps, with the deadly nature of this group. What we do in return, in response, that's another question. But let me ask you actually about something that I've been curious about. There was this arrangement that was reached between Saudi Arabia and Iran last year, 2023, where the two sides agreed to stop fighting. Or stop attacking one another. Really, it was only Iran that was attacking Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia was not attacking Iran in return, but they came to an agreement. Is that agreement holding right now? Is it helping Saudi Arabia? Is it creating any friction right now as the Saudis look out at the rest of the region and Iran is making violence really across the entire Middle East? Where does the Saudi Arabian government fit into all of this right now? How do they understand the Iranian actions, even as the Iranians are not attacking Saudi Arabia itself?
I think still there is no big result of this agreement. Still there is no, at least it's just keeping the two countries not accuse each other in a public, in a media, in official. At least it's open the map for progress in the future to cooperate, and at least it will reduce the radicals in Iran to understand how they can act regionally and in the world scene. And the Iranian still they working hard to stabilize the politics in the region, to stable the stability in the region, and to expand their power. But I think they have other war inside Iran, and Saudis and UAE relation, good relation with Iran, will stay in a kind of everyone have a problem with the other, but without full solution to what they have problems. And still the Iranian think about the relation in the region as a Shia and Sunni. And the Saudis, they finish from this one with the MBS, and they start acting in a good way with the Shia and Sunni locally and regionally. And they think it's a problem for the future is the economy and the stability and peace. But the Iranian, they don't think about it like this. They think about it as a Khamenei strategy, as expanding the al-Imam al-Muntadhar and his power as a Shia leader. And this problem is not only with Saudi or UAE, it's a problem with the world and a problem with Israel, with America. And the Saudis, this is very important to understand the reaction, why there is a peace deal or there is agreement with Iran. The Americans, they went to the deal before the Saudis, and they went secretly and through Oman, and they have a deal without negotiate this with Saudi, without caring about Arab needs and demands in the region, and why the American come in to blame us now if we have an agreement with Iran. They have it before, and they have it in their way and their interests, and we should have the same. But if it's, maybe we are like America, one day we will stop this agreement if it affects us. And this is the politics. It's a very simple politics.
I understand. Last question for you, Abdulaziz. The question that I think everyone is wondering, normalization between Saudi Arabia and Israel. Do you think it will happen? Yes or no? And why?
Yes. And it's the end of the road. And it will happen anyway, today, or tomorrow, or after 1 year, or after 5 years, 10 years. It's natural. It's natural. And it will happen because there is a lot of things in common between Saudi Arabia and Israel. And there is a lot of interests for the two countries and for all of the region of a new Middle East. And our plans in, as a Saudis in, for the economy, it connects with a stable region, with Israel, Jordan, Egypt, and Palestine, and all of the region. We look to the region as a potential of good economy, good trade, to become normal like any region in this world. And it will happen. It's a nature.
Inshallah.
Inshallah.
Well, Abdulaziz Al-Khamis, thank you very much for joining the FTD Morning Brief.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, here's what FTD has on tap for you today. FTD's cyber team is working through the findings of an 8-month investigation by the House Homeland Security Committee. The report revealed that U.S. ports are using Chinese manufactured equipment to track the movement of goods, including military assets. Worryingly, the committee was able to confirm that Chinese companies can, quote, manipulate U.S. maritime equipment and technology, unquote, at Beijing's direction. Our cyber experts are encouraging the Biden administration to take this issue seriously and to provide the U.S. Coast Guard with whatever it needs to address this. My colleague Ord Khitri is out with a new piece in The Hill calling for Congress and the Biden administration to adjust its policy toward South Africa's president, Cyril Ramaphosa. We are talking about a massively corrupt and authoritarian government here. As the largest provider of development assistance to South Africa, Ord notes that Washington should start making some serious demands, including about the country's cozy relationship with Russia and Iran, and don't even get me started on Hamas. Relatedly, Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse from Rhode Island will be stopping by FTD tomorrow to sit down with an on-the-record event with Elaine Dzinski from FTD's Center on Economic and Financial Power in partnership with Transparency International. We'll be talking about efforts in Congress to crack down on foreign bribery and corruption. You can catch the live stream of that event tomorrow morning on FTD's website, bright and early at 8 a.m. Eastern Time. That's it for today. Read our expert analysis on our website, FTD.org. Read our quick takes on X at FTD and support our work with a tax-deductible donation at FTD.org/invest. Tune in Wednesday for another installment of the FTD Morning Brief. We'll be speaking to Israeli journalist and author Mati Friedman. He's got a lot to say about the war in Gaza, the fighting in Lebanon, the way the media covers all of it, and more. So please do tune in. Until then, I'm Jonathan Shanzer, signing off for FTD.